Welcome to Coffee and Therapy, where we spill the tea on therapy-related topics, sip our favorite coffee, and share our expertise with parents, professionals, clinicians, and anyone who could benefit from a little therapy. Hello, and welcome back to Coffee and Therapy. It is me, Alyssa.
Courtney.
Noah.
Hey. Were you about to say Courtney for yourself?
I was like, Courtney's here. No, I'm not Courtney.
Hello, it's Alyssa. Courtney.
Alyssa, Courtney, and Noah.
We should pretend that we're the other person for like an episode and see if anyone notices. Be like, hey, it's Courtney.
Oh my god. I have to do one of my friends slash
welcome to Coffee and Therapy. Pew 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 pew. Who am I?
She gives me like so much crap because she goes, you get to listen to Courtney giggle on the whole episode. So it'll be easy to be me because I just giggle.
Well, apparently I go pew 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 pew
pew pew pew pew.
I do that. I knew you were going to say that. Noah's been potty training her child, if you haven't, you know, seen any sagas. So, yeah, so on the brain.
I'm entrenched in pee-pee and the doo-doo. Yeah. Yeah.
This is exactly what our listeners want to hear.
They do. We're real people.
They do.
We got stuff going on.
I love it.
Yeah. All good stuff.
Oh, yes. Clearly we are in rare, hilarious form tonight, which I love.
Yeah.
And we were trying to figure out what we want to talk about because we have too many things we want to share with you. But last episode, if you haven't tuned in, highly suggest you pause right now and go back to the AMA and ABA update episode, which is linked in the show notes below. And take a listen to some of the topics and discussions around that, because the word that we are showcasing tonight was the main word of that episode, which is evidence-based practice. Mm-hmm. Because if you listen to the episode, which you totally just did because you paused when I told you to, great job, gold star following directions, love it, ice cream for all. You heard that the American Medical Association said that they support evidence-based services for autistic individuals. But what is that word, evidence-based? And as we tried to get you an answer, we just found more questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Courtney found something that, yes, then I recall from my research methods class that outlined sort of the tiers of what makes something evidence-based. So we figured we'd start there with you all and have some discussion around that.
Yeah.
I'm like British-y tonight.
What did you say?
I don't know why I'm like British-y tonight.
I didn't get any British vibes.
Yeah. The first thing that came into my mind was like, have you been watching Peppa Pig lately? Because I feel like
Peppa Pig. Oh, I haven't.
Oh,
I'm preparing for Canada, but that's not even British.
Yeah.
Nope. Tis French. Not. No. Yeah. Sometimes.
Yep. Well, yes. What I found, which was really interesting, that I didn't know that these tiers existed. There was also an interesting fact that Alyssa shared that we'll circle back to. But
sure.
There's like four tiers, and so at the bottom of evidence-based practice is kind of where it starts, is an emerging practice, and then it goes up to a research-based practice, and then a promising practice, and then an evidence-based practice. And so Alyssa shared with me that music therapy is at this point in time likely considered an emerging practice, but moving into a research-based practice.
And so my citation for that is just school, and I can't remember which school. So, I mean, for those listening, I'm finishing up a master's, going into a PhD, and I graduated from undergrad 10 years ago. So, you know, if it's from my undergrad school, I would assume we're at research-based practice. And in looking at the definitions, which I will put these in the show notes as well for listeners, because an emerging practice says it has anecdotal evidence of effectiveness and then research has not been conducted, which is untrue. Whereas research-based practice says some research studies have demonstrated positive effects on outcomes while other studies have not. Based on research that may or may not clearly demonstrate that, the practice led to improved outcomes, and then multiple studies have been conducted. So I would say for the most part, specific protocols and programming within music therapy absolutely has to be a research-based practice. However, I will say in looking at this,
promising practice looks, look at, I could see that.
Promising practice, for those who aren't staring, yeah. says it's shown to have positive effects on outcomes. The research design does not clearly demonstrate that the practice led to the improvement, and there's an insufficient number of studies conducted to demonstrate its effectiveness.
Which I find, because I have been doing a ton of evaluations for music therapy this year, that is always the burden of proof that I find myself tasked with, is really being able to demonstrate that the music in particular is what led to the specific skill development. So that's why I, when I was reading that bullet for promising practice, I thought, oh, I could see music therapy being categorized there. But again, I recognize my bias, and I think, of course, it's not an evidence-based practice because, well, there's a few things.
It is, in some ways.
Right. And I say that, to my previous I say episode that because... too. We know that the medical model in particular is really looking for a lot of quantitative data, and music therapy tends to have lots of qualitative based research. Correct. So I think that it's not only do we not have a large body of research, the body of research is vastly qualitative, which just does not meet the criteria that the medical model is looking for to ultimately place us in a category of evidence-based, which I understand. I think that music being so highly mathematical, being so formulaic, can lend itself really well to being measured in a quantitative study. But I think that a lot of musicians, unfortunately, just don't naturally think that way. So I think having studies that are really intentionally collaborative between those more math-minded, those more data kind of centered folks is really what's going to keep propelling the profession. But another thing too, which I always say to other music therapists, I'm like, look, it's not an excuse, but we haven't been around that long as a profession. Professions that we tend to be compared to have some more time under its belt. It has a larger body of clinicians too. We're a small cohort.
It's more that, I mean, we have been around since the 40s, and music therapy research has been done since before that, because people who are doing their dissertations in medicine for their medical doctorates were researching music therapy. That's where our first research comes into play. Wow. So we've been around, but the issue is kind of multiple fold. The first point you said, Noah, that so much of it's qualitative. Because of that, you can't evolve from those initial tiers of research. So quite often, studies in music therapy are pilot and feasibility studies, which aren't publishable in most journals. Like, I am currently running a pilot and feasibility study. It is not going to be publishable in any journals because it's not quantitative enough. If it's not published, it's not documented as research. Yeah. So then it's still stuck in emerging practice, even if it's based in a quantitative and reliable protocol. And I am using quantitative measurements, but because it in itself is just pilot and feasibility, because it's the first level of research, we don't have enough clinicians continuing on that research to go from pilot and feasibility to an actually pilot study, to doing a randomized control trial, to doing a randomized control trial with multiple people to increase the power of that study. To be evidence-based, there's a power that the research has to hold. And quite often we just don't get enough participants in a music therapy research study to have the power. So even if we had 1,000 articles on the efficacy of music therapy, right? We had the top tier efficacy trial in music therapy. If we don't have enough participants to give it the power it needs, it's not going to help us be evidence-based. Yeah. So that's why I say emerging.
As I'm looking through the criteria, so the criteria for evidence-based practice is shown to have a
positive effect. So this is also educational.
I realize it's such a different. Trying to synthesize it. Shown to have a positive effect on outcomes, the research design allows for one to infer that the practice led to, you know, skill development or improvement. Multiple high quality studies have been conducted, reviewed by a reputable organization. I thought I would see there something about there being a large body of standardized protocols or practices. I guess I am surprised to not see that there, because I would think for me as a music therapist, that always seems to stand in the way when I'm talking about what I do with other professionals. We don't have standardized protocols, right? Like how, when people ask like, well, how do you know how to structure an evaluation? How do you know how to identify what material to use in just your regular therapy sessions? It really does rely so much on, oh, well, you have to have a foundation of understanding like the inner workings of the brain, how therapy works. You also have to be highly creative, specifically as a creative arts therapist. But that's really interesting to me that that is not what's holding us back, that we don't have
And it's just the quote unquote quality of the research. And Courtney, you're sending us a bunch of articles to help define evidence-based practice, because to our listeners, we say that word all the time, right? Everyone uses EBP, evidence-based practice. We throw it out there. And then we were all like, okay, what is like the definition of this? And Courtney, everything you're sending, it's slightly different.
Yeah, that's what I'm like, I'm so curious about. And, you know, the behavior analyst and me, you know, we were always taught everything is very clear, concise. Like, I want my operational definitions of exactly, you know, how many research studies are needed to prove that it's an evidence-based practice. And I can't find that anywhere. Everything is so different. Like, this one is saying kind of like what we've been talking about. There are definable outcomes. It's measurable. It's defined according to practical realities. You know, when these two terms are used interchangeably, evidence-based practice is more appropriate. Like, I just, I'm not exactly sure, to be honest.
Ooh, and I have another one to drop in the chat, too. Sometimes our research goes on real time, y'all, when we're just like, we have a moment where we go, we need to talk about that, and we need to talk about it now.
Well, and to be honest, like our conversation that we had about the AMA and their decision to, you know, modify that verbiage and everything, that spurred a lot of conversation at my company between BCBAs and the residents that I work with. And a lot of conversation came up in like, you know, we need to also like educate our families on what evidence-based practice is. And if we are having a hard time
defining it.
How are we, and again, like we had this conversation, our families are striving for answers. They're striving for any type of support that they can get for their child. And if they don't even know, you know, what an evidence-based practice is, they're going to hope and jump into, you know, well, this looks good enough, you know, like this is an interesting find that we can't actually define.
And I feel like the term evidence-based practice has been used as a way to create a divide and some legitimacy, because in fairness, right, there are some other modalities, therapies, I can't even think of one in particular right now, where there is zero research, right? It's all like good vibes and happy thoughts. And knowing that that's not evidence-based, you can still choose to engage in those types of experiences kind of at your own risk. But I don't like the very divisive, like, if it's evidence-based, it's good. If it's not, good luck. There's a spectrum at play here. And I think that's what's not being recognized.
Right. Well, I mean, even promising practice, it is shown to have positive effects. The research design doesn't clearly demonstrate that the practice, and what this means is that the practice in and of itself led to the improvement. It means there's too many confounding variables to say 100%. It was the musical component of music therapy that showed the difference and was a comparison study. That's also important. There's not a ton of comparison studies, even when we talk evidence-based practice. Let me get to that in a minute. But promising practice and a research-based practice versus evidence-based practice, it doesn't mean that that's a bad thing. It means that it is in itself emerging and showing promise and showing perspective. And I would bet, I can't say 100%, that there are things that are billable through insurance that are promising practices.
Oh, yeah, I think
so. Like, they're absolutely, yeah. I was saying that I go to the chiropractor, right? Chiropractic care in some protocols and procedures is absolutely at the level of evidence-based, but I know it's often not. And sometimes it's billable through insurance and sometimes it's not. Right. And it just is a matter of where you go. Right. And it's because of if they're using only the evidence-based chiropractic protocols, then it, I think it can be billable. I don't know. If you're a chiropractor listening, feel free to let us know. I love my chiropractors. They're great. But something I did find that kind of is helpful for listeners, you're like, cool, why'd you bring up this topic if you are just going to give us more questions than answers? So
sometimes that's valid too. Yes. It's good for people to know we don't know everything. We don't have it all figured out. And we have a lot of questions. We have a lot of questions.
Yes.
And I said, I'll put it on here on air too. I was incorrect in our previous episode. I said music therapy is an evidence-based practice for ages 2 to 14 for communication. I'm wrong. It's 0 to 14. But again, we talked about in that episode, it ends at 14 solely because we don't have the research. It doesn't mean that music therapy stopped being effective at age 14. Like, if it was effective for someone from the beginning of their life up through the age of 14, I'm going to go on a limb and say it might still be helpful for them into their teen years, young adulthood, and beyond.
Agreed.
But what also leads into what makes it an evidence-based practice is the level of evidence and the type of research study. So when we're looking at LOE, level of evidence, it goes from level 1 to level 7. And this is the biggest thing in music therapy, is that we don't have enough of the higher level studies for it to have enough of an evidence base. That's what happens a lot. So level 1 is evidence from a systematic review or a meta-analysis of randomized control trials that exist, or evidence-based clinical practice guidelines based on a systematic review. So for example, I am currently in the throes of research. My first step into that research project was me doing a systematic review of all of the protocols and procedures that align with what I am doing in my research to understand what's out there, what assessments are being used, what protocols are already being used, so I can go through what's already sort of best practice and say, great, these are elements that are definitely going to work. I'm going to include them in my study. Then a level 2 study is evidence obtained from at least one well-designed randomized control trial. That already is beyond almost all of the research we have in music therapy. There are very few randomized control trials in our field solely because you got to have the systematic reviews, the pilot, and the feasibility study to have an effective, powerful RCT. And how many years does it take to do that, right? In ABA, you have a baseline of pilot and feasibility studies already set for you that hundreds, if not thousands, of people have done. So you know, like, okay, it is feasible to implement this. We have seen a positive impact on a couple children. Let's do a randomized control trial. And you have thousands of participants to choose from. Mm-hmm. We only have music therapy clients, which are fewer and farther between because there's fewer and farther of us implementing it. Like Noah was saying, the base of who is providing care is just so much smaller that we don't even get to level 2 at most of it. It says like EG at large multi-site randomized control trial. Getting a multi-site study, it's my plan, but it's going to be really hard. Like it's going to take me, my dissertation is the pilot and feasibility up through level 1, 2, 3, 4 to try to get this to be an actually powerful study that is on its way to being an evidence-based protocol, but I'm only one person. And if I'm the only person doing the research, that's not going to make it evidence-based.
Well, so if it needs to be multi-site, if that's an important criteria,
would be helpful.
Would a setting like hospital-based music therapists be, would that be easier to be able to replicate across multiple settings, because usually hospitals are a part of a healthcare system, so there's multiple.
And usually maybe then they're all centered in one IRB, so they're doing a lot of those things. But it's a matter of, do they have the people? For my, you know, my research, it's autistic and neurodivergent individuals who aren't having any other things, right? So they're not having medical needs that would eliminate them from this study because it would be a confounded variable. Mm-hmm. So, and that, but that's the, I can't think of the name of the pacifier, the lullaby pacifier that they have. Music therapists in their cars listening to this are screaming. For those that are listening that aren't music therapists, hi, music therapy has this really cool thing that are in NICUs where it helps with the sucking feedback loop to help with feeding, where they suck on a pacifier and it plays lullaby music in time with the rate of their sucking. So
what?
It's
where they do it.
I think
a friend of mine was, one of my friends who is a music therapist, like, was not only in that study, I think she's one of the kind of rock stars of it.
Wow.
I would believe it. I don't want to be wrong. So I need
California.
So I'm pretty positive it's Kate Gefeller at Florida State University.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll be thinking of.
But it was a multi-hospital.
So maybe that's what I'm thinking. Okay.
Yes. I could be wrong. But
anyway, the whole point of that story was simply to illustrate some of these studies have been conducted at the level that we need to see.
And that's just level 2.
In a hospital setting. Okay.
I'm pretty certain you have to be at level 4 to be considered an evidence-based practice.
Okay, that was going to be one of my questions. Okay.
And I could be wrong, but this
How does one determine if it's at a level 4? Like, when you read a research study, is that at the top?
I think it's more your interpretation. So, like, part of assignments I had to do for, like, research class was, like, what level study was this?
Gotcha. Oh, it'd be so nice if it was coded at the top. Like, this is a level.
Yeah, that would be. Yeah.
Or because then you could search through databases with that criteria and then you could say, okay, how did they conduct the study to be at this level and how can I replicate that in my work?
Yeah.
And what's tricky and like, so I really want to say to listeners, like a lot of this is like what's in my brain and I don't feel confident in some of the information I'm sharing. So like I give my space.
Which is big for Alyssa. Wow.
Yeah, I know. I give myself so much space to be wrong. Like you probably don't even need to be a level 4 to be evidence-based. You have to have so many level 1s or something. Please, if you know the answer, we would love to hear from you. coffeeandtherat@gmail.com.
You're a researcher. Please come join us.
I am an emerging researcher. I have a promising researcher. No, I'm emerging. I'm tier 1. But what's funny about all of this, right, is that we're talking nitty gritty about protocols, right? Like my research is on executive function skill strategies through music therapy. That is a nitty gritty aspect. That in itself doesn't make music therapy as a whole evidence-based. It contributes to one element of the practice. So for example, executive function skill work is highly under-researched for autistic and neurodivergent individuals, specifically autistic individuals. Yet OT, and no shade to this, OT works on executive function skills. Mm-hmm. Speech language pathologists work on executive function skills. SLP and OT, I'm pretty certain speech therapy and occupational therapy are considered evidence-based practices to be billable at the level they are.
Yeah.
But the protocols and the implementation materials they're using aren't. So does it matter if the protocol is or the entity of itself? And who determines that?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a really good question.
Like, it works because the practice itself is evidence-based?
Maybe my guess is, like, because a lot, like, their foundational whatever interventions that they use are evidence-based, and a lot of times, I'm sure you too use it as well, like, you're pairing interventions and strategies together, so maybe because the foundations are evidence-based, and then when they bring in some of these, you know, I don't know, that might be that. That's my guess.
I think that with any type of work or practice or service, there has to be some blend of intuition with evidence-based strategies, right?
Yes.
Even a doctor, right? Of course, they know that they have their standard series of tests that they have to run if you have these symptoms, but they're thinking outside of the box all the time. How do you think we cure and solve and treat?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that also brings up a good point too. Like you could be implementing evidence-based practice, doing it, you know, as the research did it, but you as the actual therapist, you know, might not be effective. Yep. And, you know, I don't know how nicer to say
or, it. Or even, let's flip it on the other side, 100%, right? It's contingent on the quality of the implementer and maybe not the protocol itself. But let's say, too, that myself, a music therapist who isn't in a billable practice or field that's considered right now evidence-based as a whole, right? Music therapy is for some things, isn't for others, and it's quite up for debate. Whereas you, Courtney, are a BCBA who's doing ABA, who is very centered in evidence-based practice. Let's say we're using the same assessment, and we're allowed to, right? Because there's certain assessments any master's level clinician
can use.
Let's say we're using the same assessment, we're measuring the same skills, we're implementing it in the same way. You're just doing it through maybe a play-based modality and I'm doing it through a music modality. Mm-hmm. Who is this arbitrary them that's determining one of those things is evidence-based or more effective?
Yeah.
And what if that child, let's say we're even working with the same child, let's say they hate toys. Let's say Courtney chose dinosaurs. Let's say they hate dinosaurs and now they're just shut down, right? But they love music. Who's going to have a better outcome?
Yeah, you, like, music.
Me. Yep. But I'm not evidence-based and not billable. Like it is just the cycle of, is evidence-based practice even what matters?
The who is it up to depends on the audience that you're working with. So if you're working on a shared team, like you're saying, there's all different types of therapies at play. Your audience, your consumer could simply be the client, the client's support circle. So including family, care managers, right? But like you're also saying, because there's a financial aspect associated with it in terms of payment, I would say that the person who's determining whether it's evidence-based or not is the person who's processing the claim, right?
Yeah.
Processing your invoice.
Yep.
So, well, and even that, let's say that's, for example, my insurance.
And it's not discretionary for them. It's not, that person has no therapy training, presumably, right? They're just the person's in account receivables who has to process, right? So they have very specific guidelines that they look, does it meet not? Yes. They send it back if it doesn't, right? So is there going to be a code that they're looking for or whatever the case may be, you know?
Well, that's a whole other episode too.
yes.
CPT codes, because how we bill and code for things, anyone, theoretically, anyone can bill a CPT code. It's just a matter of if they're deemed reimbursable by the insurance companies, right? So the them that determine evidence-based practice aren't even the them who determine billable, right? These are all separate entities. A research system and functionality is determining, are you an emerging or an evidence-based practice or a research-based practice? Insurance companies are just determining, are we going to pay for you or not? Because at the end of the day, a BCBA, an SLP, an OT, a PT walk into an insurance company and they all bill the same CPT code.
They all walk into a bar.
I wasn't going to say that, but I said they walk into an insurance company.
I was like, set it up.
They all bill the same CPT code. They all can. It's not on the same day because then it'll all get bounced back, but they can all build the same code, right? If you are truly working on that skill, it doesn't even matter what protocol you're using. You're just billing the code. Like how you get reimbursed for services doesn't actually have anything to do with the protocol and procedure, right? When you're billing for assessment, let's say you implemented the VBMAP, which is a standard practice in ABA, you're not billing a CPT code for the VBMAP. You're billing a CPT code for assessment.
Yeah.
Which anyone can bill that CPT code for assessment, or you're billing for a behavioral therapeutic intervention, which a mental health clinician bills for, which music therapists bill for in places where in states where they can bill. If you're billing for like sensory motor rehab, OTs can bill that, PTs can bill that, music therapists who are doing NMT neuro rehab items can bill that, right? Your billing is based on your goals and objectives. And can you prove that you worked on the thing you said you did?
Yeah.
And that's where the evidence base lies, not in the therapeutic practice as a whole for billing entities, right? It's just, it's so nuanced in every side of it. And there's not just, like you're saying, there's not a clear textbook objective definition of like, this is why. Courtney and Nora just looking at me listening.
I mean, so where do we, I, because I think we're both just thinking, you know, where do we go from here? What true value does assigning something the label of an evidence-based practice bring?
Correct.
Yeah.
And I don't think it does, like, I think it brings pride in a different sense, yeah, right? Of, I would love to make a protocol that's evidence-based practice for music therapy, just to say, like, wow, I created this thing that people can use, like, really use.
Yeah.
And I know it works. It's validated, yeah, and it will help this person in this way. My goal is for the things I'm creating to help change someone's life. I don't care that they call it evidence-based practice.
Well, I just positively. And maybe that's the piece. Yeah. Because maybe that's really the origin of why the title evidence-based practice is held so highly and so protected, is the underlying sentiment is we want to make sure that these practices and these therapies are helping people,
yeah,
as opposed to hurting.
Yeah. But I mean, on that note, and I'm going to say the crappy thing, if we're saying that ABA has been proven to be traumatic,
I knew that's where we're going to go.
Also calling it evidence-based practice and talking positive, like, I know, to make Courtney uncomfortable, we were talking about, like, sitting with discomfort. Wouldn't that be a good episode to have? And I said, Courtney, I make you uncomfortable on this podcast all the time. Like, I don't, positive isn't in any of the things we discussed, right? It doesn't say it leaves a positive impact. It doesn't say it leaves,
yeah,
a positive function.
Yeah.
Oh, life,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The word positive is in the bullet points for the Peabody.
So, and the Peabody one, though, that's for education.
Yeah.
Like, this is an evidence-based practice in education. When looking at evidence-based practice in the medical field, it's not. Right, shown to have a positive effect on student outcomes. Mm-hmm. And we're going to link to all these things we've just been, like, saying and sharing with you listeners. But, right. So then if it's not positive, does it negate the evidence-based practice? Right? Are they going to withdraw that from ABA, even though there's, like, substantial evidence?
Hmm.
Right. Wow. Correct. And I think your question, Noah, is the better question of why does this necessarily matter, right? And it doesn't, but it does if the AMA is saying we only recommend evidence-based practices for this, we only recommend XYZ for this, then it really matters.
And I get that we have to things have to have standards, right?
We have to have
benchmarks to measure from, to compare with. I understand that. I think that I am just sitting with the fact that this is a standard that exists that doesn't quite seem to still be well defined, but is widely accepted. So I'm sitting with that strange juxtaposition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I agree.
And I think there probably is a better definition that we are not finding that is, like, you need this many studies to be evidence-based, but maybe not. I, like, my heart wants to be like, there has to be, like Corey said, a number.
I would love to do a part two. I would love to do a part two for this down the road where we bring in some researchers. I know you, Alyssa, the program that you're in right now and the program that you'll be starting for your PhD, there's lots of researchers, granted they're music therapy researchers, but that doesn't make it any less important or valid. I would love to have
them on the podcast.
No, but I think even if it's not them, right, being able to connect you with someone, I'd love to have different disciplines represented just to get a better sense of what we're missing here. And I think that would be a great episode for us in terms of sip, spill, or share, to just sip and let them share. Because this feels kind of like a spill episode where we're just like, here's the stuff and it's everywhere and what do we do with it? And that's fine. The three of us, and when Sarah's here, the four of us, we don't know everything. No. If we have given anyone the sense that we know everything, so sorry. That is a huge misrepresentation. I mean, Alyssa knows a lot of things. Let's be honest. Yes. She knows a lot of things. All right. Yes. She's like, speak for yourself. I know a lot of things.
No, this one, I, like, feel confident that I generally know, but I also am like, there's clearly something I'm missing, because we wouldn't have this word so universally recognized if there wasn't a clearer definition. So I think this is an also call out to our listeners. If you are a researcher, if you know a researcher, we would love to have you on the podcast. We want to hear from you because clearly this
Set us straight.
Fix it. We love being wrong, actually, when there's a better way to do it. We're actively, I think, hoping that, like, this can't be it. There has to be some more systematic definition. And yeah, email us coffeeandtherate@gmail.com. DM us Instagram, coffeeandtherate, T-H-E-R-A-T-E-A, right? T-E-A. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's important that we hit on this from last week. It sparked such a great response in our social media. People are still messaging us back and forth on Instagram. A lot of people have been listening to the episode and excited for the topics of discussion. I think the other thing it spurred that we are definitely going to go into, listeners, is something we went into a little bit tonight of, like, insurance billing, of evidence-based practices are billable through insurance, but who determines that really? Is it the evidence-based practice? Is it the entity itself? Is it the coding? Is it all of those nuances? So kind of talking, there's been a lot of focus centered around that, that I think would be helpful to go into.
Maybe for today then, what we're hoping to instill in you as the listener is maybe just some healthy questioning of why are we holding so tightly to this notion of evidence-based practice? We being people that exist, consumers of services and therapies, and a healthy questioning of not only our orientations and our biases, but maybe we have been a little harsh, or we have perceived the work that we do, if we are clinicians, to be better than other types of therapies. You know, I'm just, for some reason, I'm thinking about other holistic, non-United States-centered practices like acupuncture, you know, just they're all so incredibly valid, but they're different, and we probably have these perceptions of these different things, and maybe in music therapy. And I think we have to just ask ourselves why more, because I'm raising my hand and saying I totally went into this episode being like, oh yeah, I have a really firm sense of what constitutes evidence-based. And now that I'm looking at these multiple articles that Alyssa is going to link in the show notes, I feel way less certain, which you'd think of anything, I would have had the opposite.
Yeah, I agree.
Response. So.
Well, I think you said something really important there too, that I want to highlight as someone who does feel confident in this statement as an emerging researcher. This notion that things are better than, in an evidence-based format, means there has to be comparison studies where you are doing randomized control trials where you're sorted into two different protocols, let's say music therapy and ABA, and you're comparing the efficacy of those against each other and seeing that. There are not a ton of comparison studies, even within ABA, because also that is so contingent on the consumer and the client that's being given the study and the quality of the clinician. Comparison studies are really hard to do. So there isn't this notion that one thing is directly better than. Some things might have a larger evidence base than others. And when you're sorting into this good or bad category, it could be more, one has more weight than the other in the sense of research. But as far as comparison studies go, there are very few across the board that are validated, reliable, have effective power, have, you know, conclusions and discussion sections where they feel really confident that this thing was better than that thing. You'll see the most comprehensive comparison studies in like drug trials where like one drug was considerably better than the other for treating this disease, where there's not human error at play. I know, Courtney, you found something that I bet you want to say because you put it in the chat.
No, I mean, I think that I found this other phrase or quote that describes evidence-based practice, and I just wanted to highlight really the second sentence, but I'll read the whole quote. It says, evidence-based practice is the contentious, right?
Yep.
contentious, explicit.
Conscientious.
Conscientious. Sorry. Thank you. No, thank yeah. you. Conscientious, Melissa. Explicit, and judicious use of current best empirical evidence when making decisions about how to practice, when providing information and care for clients slash patients. This is this section is the part that I appreciate. This best evidence should be combined with practitioner expertise and should consider the characteristics, states, needs, values, and preference of those who will be affected. And I mean, we were just talking about human error, and we had talked about earlier, you know, the type of therapy that's being provided is really contingent on the therapist as well. So this is also very interesting. Like, I know that most studies try to avoid bias and things like that, but this is also just something interesting yeah. to, you know, think about as well.
I will save that. And I also just found, to help close this out, on the American Music Therapy Association website, the way they're defining evidence-based practice is a music therapist's clinical practice is guided by the integration of the best available research evidence, the client's needs, values, and preferences, and the expertise of the clinician. So that also calls into question, is it an evidence-based practice if you're doing something that's maybe validated and standardized, but you don't know how to do it?
Yeah.
Like, you read an article on it and you want to try it, but you don't have training or skill in it yet.
Yeah.
And you don't have supervision around it or support. Yeah. Even though it is,
which happens a lot. I hear about across that the board.
Yeah. Like, the work I do is so subtle and nuanced. There's not a lot of music therapists who are doing social cognitive executive function skill approaches for neurodivergent and autistic adolescents. Like, that's so ridiculously specific. Even if I made it a standardized protocol, someone would need to be trained in it and have experience with it for it to be effective and evidence-based. So
even well, the good thing that Alyssa provides supervision.
I sure do. Yes. And I'm taking on, I don't know if I'm taking on anyone new. I've got a couple new supervision people coming on this fall, but.
Yes. Yes, you do.
I'm open to it and more.
But I was going to say, like, I think that also highlights like why when you think of ABA, I think most people think of autism services. And in fact, ABA can be widely used in so many other facets of the workforce. And because you think of autism, when people want to go into ABA, that's where they go. And then that's where all the research is. Whereas there, again, are so many other facets. Even though ABA is an evidence-based practice, there are so many other facets of the field that, you know, probably don't have as much research too.
Yeah. So is your brain getting tired, Courtney, after the conscientious judicious?
Yeah. And the other thing, it's so funny. My vocabulary has dumbed down after all these years of just working with little kids. And so I don't ever have to read these big
You're
words.
Like A, B, C. Yep. Why are we not singing ABC?
Exactly. Those are not normal words that I use in my regular vocabulary.
I don't think I've seen conscientious written out in a long time. So yeah, I'll give you that one. That's the problem. I think I said on the last podcast, and I probably sounded like a total witch with a B. But I was like, were my words too big? Because sometimes I just use words, and I'm like, I could say less.
Well, and I think this is such a, like I said earlier, this topic, we are spilling. This is a lot of thinking for the three of us. I think usually we tend to pick topics that we can organically talk about and feel maybe a little bit more prepared to discuss, in that we do this thing or we talk about this thing often. This is more of a head scratcher, more of a thinking as opposed to knowing episode, and I think that that's just really taxing on the brain. So I am cool
because
with
because we do yes, talk about it all the time. We don't know anything about it, but everyone's using this word in our lives. Mm-hmm. It's like, I think the problem is we thought we knew.
Yeah.
You know, we went to talk about the thing we thought we knew. We went, wait a minute. Wait a second. What? This makes no sense.
And it's been such a cornerstone in the training of the work that we've done. We have just been told and told and told and told and told the importance of this and how we are this, but we're not this, and we are. So I think this is just a lot of thinking, and I think this feels like a good place for us to pause for today, because I really want to leave anyone who is listening to this to think in the ways that we have, and to have those pauses that you've been hearing us naturally encounter throughout this conversation, because I think more work has to be done across the board, first better defining evidence-based practice, so that we as teachers, clinicians, people going out and being ambassadors for evidence-based practices, or for practices that we want to see become evidence-based, can talk about this from a place of better knowledge and confidence and information. So for me, that's how I'm feeling. I'm feeling like I have learning that I need to do.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%.
But I think a really great discussion around it. And again, if you're a listener who has knowledge we don't have, please email us. I'll say it again, coffeeandtherapy@gmail.com, or find us on Instagram at coffeeandtherapy, T-H-E-R-A-T-E-A, because we would love to hear from you.
And on that note, have a wonderful day and goodbye.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Coffee and Therapy. Keep the conversation flowing and follow us over on Instagram at Coffee and Therapy. Questions, thoughts, ideas? Email us coffeeandtherapy@gmail.com. We can't wait for you to listen in again soon.